From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made 200 years in the future. Let me set the scene for you. Earth's population has swelled to 30 billion people. We have failed to stop catastrophic climate change. New York City is protected by a massive seawall, but many other cities are underwater. Resources are scarce. Most people don't have jobs. Humans have colonized the solar system. Mars is its own nation, and it is a military power. Humans draw resources from the asteroid belt, competing for ice and water and minerals. And the poor souls forced to mine the asteroids are known as belters, and they are considering a revolution of their own. How does this all sound? It's the plot of a novel and television series called The Expanse. Hollywood is taking its shot at drawing up our collective future on screen or in books, and most of the time it's not pretty. The new film Ad Astra offers a look at humanity's effort to reach deeper into space, only to find loneliness and isolation at the other end. Amidst this all, astrophysicist Adam Frank has a piece in the Washington Post urging us to consider a new story, a new narrative, a new way of telling the story of climate change, human civilization, and our home planet. He writes, quote, "Climate change is not our fault. Don't get me wrong, human activity absolutely has caused the rise in temperature that our scientists are hard at work documenting. And without doubt, those who continue to drive climate change denial are deeply and profoundly worthy of blame. I mean rather that all human history is the attempt to harvest new forms of energy to power our cherished project of civilization. We triggered climate change by mistake when we tripped over fossil fuels as part of that long effort. It wasn't because we are evil or unworthy." And Frank continues, quote, "I've seen the power of this new story. By shifting from blame to possibility, people are free to imagine climate change as a challenge full of risk and possibility, rather than just a death sentence from accrued guilt. Many people who don't consider themselves environmentalists get more engaged when the conversation turns to human success and capacity for innovation," end quote. This hour, we've invited Adam Frank to join us to discuss this new story of climate change and to review the Hollywood stories of climate change. He's going to put his reviewer hat on. He is a professor of astrophysics at the University of Rochester. His newest book is Light of the Stars, Alien Worlds and the Fate of the Earth, but a reviewer today. Welcome.
It's great to be back.
Are you ready? We going to the movies?
So Adam, nerd out.
Adam got in touch with me about a month ago and said, you know, Ad Astra's coming out, Brad Pitt's in it, Tommy Lee Jones. It's kind of a look at, pushing deeper into space and looking for other signs of life in the universe, of which Adam knows a little bit about, having created the newest version of the Drake equation, the equation that tells us the likelihood that there is other technological civilization in the universe, or has been.
Has been, yeah.
Is was. Or has been. And I think what you said is the odds that we're alone is 1 in 10 billion trillion.
Yeah, there's 10 billion trillion planets out there where life and potentially civilizations could form. So the only way that we're the alone, or not alone, the only way we're the only time it's happened is if all of those experiments failed, 10 billion trillion experiments failed, and ours succeeded. Come on.
So, yeah. So I'm on board with the numbers, and Adam has thought about this. So now Hollywood is, and so he gets in touch with me and says, Ad Astra's coming out, let's see it. I could not go. You went, and you came back, and you said, it sucked.
It sucked. It was terrible.
I was so excited we were going to have this great hour of like, Hollywood's getting it right. No, it sucked, huh?
Well, what's interesting about Ad Astra, and this is, you know, sort of one of the things we can talk about, is like, you know, the question is often, and especially the question that will come to me as a scientist is, did they get the science right? And the interesting thing we can ask is, when does it matter for Hollywood to get the science right?
Because in Star Trek or in Star Wars, does it matter?
Again, it depends. In Star Wars, it doesn't matter at all because they're not even trying. That's not what Star Wars is about. It's a space opera, you know. And they've got like warp drives and hyper drives. But really, it's a kind of a fantasy set in space. And as long as they're kind of, the important thing is that they're consistent. Okay, they're good. Now, Star Trek, on the other hand, is a very interesting example because they were an example of great science fiction where they were extending science that we know now quite a ways, And what they did is they actually kind of created science. They created this idea of warp drive. They created the teleporter was, you know, the reason why Star Trek had the teleporter was basically it was too expensive to keep showing the shuttle going back and forth. They're like, okay, we need a cheap way of showing people going from planet to the ship. But then that actually stimulated people years later to think about teleportation. Would it be possible? So Star Trek was an example where they took the science seriously, but they were going to build their own. They were going to extend what we knew quite a ways and build their own science. Star Wars, it was like, who cares? We just want to tell a fun story.
Ad Astra. Well, let's get a sense for what the film's about. And I've got a clip that we can listen to. Brad Pitt is who in the movie, by the way?
Brad Pitt is a pilot, military. You know, there's a space force. This takes place maybe like 50 years in the future, and Brad Pitt is a well-regarded space force pilot astronaut.
And he has been called in by the government for a super classified secret meeting. Let's listen to what happens.
Major, what can you tell us about the Lima Project?
First manned expedition to the outer solar system, sir. Some 29 years ago.
And the commander was?
He was my father, sir. The ship disappeared approximately 16 years into the mission. No data was ever recovered. Deep space missions were halted after that.
Roy, we have something that might come as quite a shock to you. We believe your father is still alive near Neptune.
My father's alive, sir?
We believe so.
Roy, the surge seems to be the result of some kind of antimatter reaction. Now, the Lima Project was powered by that material, and your father was in charge of it. Now, we're talking about a potentially unstoppable chain reaction here. The uncontrolled release of antimatter could ultimately threaten the stability of our entire solar system. All life could be destroyed.
Major, we would like you to send a personal message on Mars by secure laser to what we hope is the Lima Project. What is happening out there is a crisis of unknown magnitude. Now we're counting on you to help us find him.
Okay, so Brad Pitt's got to go find his dad, Tommy Lee Jones, who is way out near Neptune, monkeying around with antimatter and could literally destroy the solar system 50 years in the future. First of all, how does that work for the science?
Well, the science of, like, you know, he's got an antimatter engine, and somehow, like, you know, the antimatter engine busted open, and now the entire solar system is at risk is ridiculous, right? I mean, you could see the script consultant saying, like, okay, here's something I could work. But, you know, as a science idea, it's pretty ridiculous. But the most important thing about that is, like, the whole movie was in that tone of voice. No matter what happened, everybody was talking like this. You know, it was just the mood of that movie, you know, sort of infected everything, including the representation of the science.
Are you saying that my father...
Right.
Is still alive. This may come as a shock to you, Adam.
The destruction of all life. It's a crisis.
It's almost as big a crisis as cliches in script writing.
So it's bad writing.
It's bad writing. And it's
personal melodrama, just swamping it.
What they're doing is what's interesting is, so I was asked by NBC to sort of do something on the science of this. And what I found was that, you know, just like I did the script consulting for Doctor Strange, they had a scientist script consultant who did like a reasonable job.
I love how you dropped that, by the way. You got to be a little more, real briefly as an aside, you did script consulting for the movie Doctor Strange.
For Doctor Strange, right. So I now know a little, and I've done actually for a couple of other scripts that didn't materialize. So, you know, I get what sort of the directors want out of the script consultants. And there's many ways in which Ad Astra is a scientifically realistic movie. It's just that the mood, that sort of dark, bleak mood of the film infects the representation of science. So, you know, Ad Astra is really a movie about loneliness, and they're going to use space as a metaphor for loneliness, and they're going to beat you over the head with a stick about how this movie is about loneliness, and we're using space as a metaphor. So like the art direction, it's very retro. So the visualization of what the spaceships look like sort of looks very 1960s in a way.
Buggies.
Yeah, right.
Moon buggies.
There's a very famous scene there in the movie with a moon buggy chase, and moon buggies look exactly like the Apollo moon buggies. Like, why would 50 years in the future they look like that? And so it just makes, I mean, on one level, it's just a terrible movie. It's just a terrible movie. And then on another level, as a representation of what the future in space looks like, which I think is very important because we're very close. Like, you know, between Elon Musk, you know, the private space industries, you know, in the 50 years, we really could have a lot of people in space. And this was just a terrible representation of what that might look like.
Did you say that there is voiceover in this?
There is an incredible, I mean, Brad Pitt is constantly narrating what he's feeling and what's happening, which is, you know, my understanding is the worst thing you can do in a movie. I'm now feeling really sad. Oh my God, when I saw that, it made me full of terror. And as opposed to having, you know, having the character show that by his actions.
Or feel it. I mean, Adam and I were talking before the show began about how Space Odyssey, 2001, they gave you the loneliness, the quiet, by giving you these long stretches of no dialogue and then just breathing, right?
Right. That was as if you were in the space helmet and just that breath, kind of the ragged breath going back and forth. Right. This one, they have to, like, you have to keep getting, they keep taking you inside his head, which is, it didn't even sound realistic.
Now, spoiler alert for this film, which I don't think too many of our listeners are psyched to see right now. And in a moment, we're going to talk about The Expanse. But spoiler alerts, because I'm doing my due diligence there. But Tommy Lee Jones's character has somehow concluded that we now have evidence that there is no life in the universe and that we truly are alone. So it's not just lonely in space. It's lonely in space.
Right.
Because you're not just alone if you're an astronaut in space. Our species is alone on this tiny little rock, and we know it now. 50 years into the future, could we possibly have enough evidence to declare that we now know without a doubt we are the only technological civilization?
Absolutely not, right? It's going to take, so we're just at the point, we're at this incredibly exciting moment in human history where in the next 10 to 30 years, we're going to have actual data about the existence of life elsewhere in the universe. Now, it may not be civilizations, but certainly biospheres. But, you know, we'll have the technological capacity to do it. For stars, maybe out to 100 light years. So maybe once we get that technological capacity, then we do the studies. It'll probably take another 50 years to say within 100 light years, we can tell whether or not there are any, to be complete, as we say, whether or not there's any biospheres. But we couldn't go farther. We couldn't say 1,000 light years or 10,000 light years. So
how many light years are there?
There's pretty much an infinite number of them. The galaxy is on the order of about 100,000 light years across.
What?
The galaxy, just our galaxy, which is our city of stars.
It's
our
New York City.
1,000 light years across.
And maybe in the next 50 years, we'll be able to handle within 100 light years.
Yeah. Yeah. Because the farther away you're looking, the harder it is to get.
But somehow Tommy Lee Jones.
Right.
Has concluded we got enough to know.
The whole thing. And also, why did he have to go? They had him. He went to the edge of the solar system to make these observations. Like, that, you know, you could do it by Mars. You don't have to, you know, you could even do it from the moon. I mean, it was another sort of device. This was just a device for them to beat you over the head with, like, lonely, human beings are lonely.
Okay. So so that's Ad Astra. So it's a big fan. However, you have turned me on to a series which just got renewed and is planning its fourth season. But there are three seasons that are available now, and it's called The Expanse. It is based on a series of books, and that's what I opened the program with. So The Expanse is set not 50 years in the future, but 200 years in the future. And my understanding, just from having watched now one episode, but I've read a bunch on it, is Earth is about 30 billion people. Climate change has not been stopped in any meaningful way. So when they show New York City, there's like this super high seawall and things are sort of, the ocean is very high and other cities are sort of underwater. Resources are scarce. A lot of people don't have jobs. The UN is largely in control of Earth. Mars, which used to be an Earth colony, is now its own nation. It's become a military power. There is concern that Mars and Earth are headed for an armed conflict. And then you've got the Belters, the asteroid belt where the resources are being mined from, and they are They're not a different species, but people who live in the belt, they have different gravity. They have different sort of bone
structures. Their bodies
have begun to evolve
a little bit, in terms of response to it. Yeah.
And because we have failed with climate change and resources are so scarce, there is a real war, or at least a possible war, over resources, over ice, over water, food, things like that. You like this one a whole lot.
I'm laughing.
You can geek out a little.
I am a fanboy. Like, these books, I've been reading the Expanse series for years. I mean, I think the first books were probably 10 years ago, and it's a 9-book series that I think we're up to 7 right now. And I have read every one of those books multiple times. When the show was announced that Sci-Fi was originally on Sci-Fi, I wrote a column for NPR saying, don't get this wrong. Like, do not mess this up. I love these books.
The book series?
Yeah. Like,
kind of like the Game of Thrones fans were
exactly.
Like, what are you going to do on screen compared to on the page?
And I was exactly one of those. And I think they did a great job with it. And I also want to say, like, this is not just a matter of being a dorky fanboy, though it is. It's also that I find that you know, science fiction, when I was growing up, being a science fiction fan, you were a dork. You know, there was like 3 other people in the entire high school of, 1,000 kids who had read any of the books you read. But now, of course, science fiction and Marvel and superheroes are culture. And there's a...
You missed your window to be cool in high school.
I know. Just getting
you would
beaten
have been
up
so cool.
I know. No, but actually, I get my bragging rights now.
Yes,
now,
exactly.
You know, you can go to Google and find out the origin story of the X-Men. We had to work for it when I was.
You had to actually read the comic books.
You had to go down every week to get the comic books from the. Let's not go down that road too deep.
But on the story of the Expanse, not only do you feel like they got it right, but back to one of your original points, they get enough of the science right.
Well, that's what's really amazing about it. So, just to finish the point I was wandering off of, science fiction is really important for us now because it allows us, through stories, to map out futures that are very close. It allows us to kind of try them on. The reason why there's 10,000 stories of artificial intelligence and, you know, taking over or robots becoming conscious is because we can feel it coming. And so we tell these stories to ourselves to allow us to kind of, like, get a sense of what's going on. And the idea of a settled solar system, the next few centuries, if we make it through climate change, the next few centuries, we are without doubt going to find every nook and cranny in the solar system and build worlds there, build businesses, build life. So what's great about The Expanse is it gives us a very realistic version. It is the most realistic science fiction show on TV about space that has ever been produced. And they even like in details, right? So the amazing thing about The Expanse is you don't have warp drives, you've got rockets. They're nuclear rockets. When the rockets are on, you've got gravity, you got thrust. Just like, you know, when your car accelerates, you're pushed backwards. In The Expanse, when your rockets are on, you're pushed towards the floor. If you're on a spinning space station, then you're held against the ground by the spin. So, you know, if you're in a hollowed out spinning asteroid, you're sitting on the inside or standing on the inside of the asteroid. And there's what they call the Coriolis force, which is sort of bends, you know, there's this wonderful scene where a guy is pouring a drink and the fluid comes out of the bottle and it kind of does a corkscrew. Now, they never mention it. The guy's not like, hey, look, it corkscrewed. But that's what would happen in a real spinning space station.
And the dork scientists like you are like, yes!
I literally jumped on the couch. It was embarrassing.
You had
I was
your
like,
Tom Cruise moment.
I did. I was like, they got the Coriolis force right. But even more than that, they use the physics of space travel. They use the physics of the space environment as a character. And as you know, in the story. So like if there's a space battle, as the ship is tumbling around to reorient itself to fire its missiles, the characters inside the spaceship are being battered around. And if there's any object that's not locked down, that thing becomes a missile inside the ship that could kill you. And they use the physics so well as part of the story.
Well, so to me, the juxtaposition with your piece in the Washington Post is this. In our second half hour, we're going to talk a lot more about what you wrote for the Washington Post and why and how you view the story of climate change, not in Hollywood, not on the page and on the screen, but in what we must do now. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's interesting to look at the way Hollywood and novelists are looking at our future vis-a-vis climate change, because you're right, it gives us a chance to try on different possibilities. What you're seeing with The Expanse 200 years in the future, in your view as a scientist, is not impossible. In fact, probably there is a lot that's very likely. This show gets not only praise from scientists, it gets praise from people who who follow conflict in show and geopolitics. I mean, this is a very political and interesting show about that.
There was a, I forgot what it was. There was a International Affairs magazine.
Yeah.
Where after the first season was done, said the most interesting show about politics and diplomacy right now takes place in space. We should note that I think the second season and maybe the third season as well had 100% rating on Rotten Tomatoes. Like people, you know,
everybody. Are you a paid consultant for this show?
I'm actually about to be because I've been trying to be for a while. I love this show and I'm actually doing something for, you know, for the opening of the fourth season. I just got asked to do something for them. So now I'm about to become a paid consultant, but it doesn't matter if they didn't. I've written, you can see long before anybody would decided to pay me. I've written like four or five things about this because
you've been a fan from the beginning.
I'm a huge fan. And I think it's really, what's interesting about The Expanse is it's both hopeful, right? We, you know, it's 200 years from now, and we're still there. Like, we haven't collapsed into chaos, and we managed to expand into space and, you know, start a Martian colony, which then, of course, revolted and became its own nation. But, you know, it's both hopeful and realistic.
Yeah, and this is where I kind of wanted to ask you about the story, because in 2019, you want us to reimagine the narrative of climate change and to not feel like we're evil, we're a cancer, we're failures. And instead to think about it as it is almost inevitable that as civilizations grow, as technology becomes accessible, as we create, we are responsible, we are accountable, but just about everywhere there's going to be energy feedback, energy consumption, and probably this kind of a consequence. And what that means is we've got a challenge ahead of us, but we're not evil.
Right.
This is probably something close to inevitable for any technological civilization. So you want to be more optimistic right now, or at least a little less self-flagellating. Whereas on screen, it's kind of bleak, the narrative. Now, I realize a story 200 years in the future, we've controlled population growth and all the resources are great and everyone adopted twice the measure of the Paris Accords and it's a harmonious future. Doesn't make for great drama. So I get that. But is it so bleak that you think, is it fair? Is it too dark for you? Or do you think, no, it's a worthwhile warning?
No, I think this is interesting. Again, I do think The Expanse is somewhat hopeful, though, right? Because it's 200 years, yeah, the Earth is definitely overpopulated, but we're still here as opposed to Mad Max. It's not an apocalypse by any stretch of the imagination. Humanity is actually
resources
done...
are scarce. Yeah, no, joblessness. It's not a very happy place for most people.
Right, right. But we haven't... I mean, so I would actually say... So I still would argue that The Expanse is fundamentally hopeful in some way. But there's lots of other films out there. This is an interesting, I've been thinking about this idea of the aestheticized, if I'm saying the right word, the artful apocalypse. There's so many movies now. We're inundated by images of beautiful apocalypses. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, actually we need to start pushing back on. Because by making them so beautiful, by making them so like cool to look at, we're robbing ourselves of stories of hope. You know, and we're almost like, you know, preparing ourselves for like, yeah, of course there's going to be an apocalypse and it's going to be really cool in a horrible way. And, you know, I mean, Hollywood's not doing us any service by not offering us visions of difficult challenges, but making it through.
Which is why The Expanse, I think, stands apart for you.
Right.
And for the critics.
Exactly.
Because it's not just this cinematic, beautiful, collapsing planet. Everything's on fire, but it's gorgeous and it kind of looks like a sunset. And, you know, this morning I was at the Environmental Innovation Awards put on by the Seneca Park Zoo Society. Some wonderful, forward-thinking people there. And one of the groups being honored was the Rochester Youth Climate Leaders. There's youth climate leaders in schools. They're really doing great stuff. Starting at fifth grade, it's really cool to see, which is awesome. The one thing that I see is in pictures, you know, a lot of people, you know, they picket and they hold signs and they march and they demonstrate, but inevitably people still hold signs that say, stop denying the Earth is dying or save our planet.
Right.
And I keep going back to, was it a George Carlin line? We're like fleas on a dog and the earth is ready to shake us off if we bite too hard. The Earth is not dying. The earth is changing. It's not climate death.
Right.
It's climate change.
Right.
Right?
And it's also, you know, the thing that could die is the civilization that we're very happy with. But, you know, the Earth is going to do okay. In fact, that's the problem is we have the wrong vision. It's not about, like, saving the cute little furry bunny of the Earth. The Earth is, you know, the Earth is an animate power. There's a piece I'm thinking about writing which would sort of be themed, you know, climate change and the return of the old gods. Like, we need to understand that our problem is not saving the Earth. Our problem is to keep from, you know, pissing it off, if I can say that. You know, if we push Earth in a different direction, there is no way that we're going to be able to make it. The Earth will beat us fine. It'll create new species. You know, the Earth is very vibrant. But it's really the challenge here is for us and this kind of civilization to make it through. But trying to the idea of, like, saving the Earth. No, you don't have to worry about saving the Earth. You got to save yourself.
Well, and so last bit on The Expanse, because it's heading for a fourth season now.
Yeah.
If people are watching it just with an eye towards climate change, what do you want them to look for that you think is interesting?
Well, what's interesting is it's not like it gets mentioned very much.
No,
it's
doesn't.
Very it, much it, in the background.
It is. I mean, You see the consequences of it without it being at the forefront of the story, at least from what I've seen.
Yeah, no, that's exactly. And that's the way it is. There's never like a long discussion about climate change. What you should watch for is the scenes on Earth, particularly where the walls, you know, you see, like, for example, when the opening credits, you see the Statue of Liberty surrounded by like 30 meter high walls because the ocean is so high.
So it's kind of little cues like that.
That's what it is.
Yeah, and resource scarcity, et cetera. I see the phone ringing. We'll grab your calls if you want to weigh in on what we've seen on screen, et cetera. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. It's 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. And our guest for the hour is Adam Frank, who is an astrophysicist. His book is called Light of the Stars, Alien Worlds and the Fate of the Earth. It's outstanding. It probably should be required reading in high school classrooms or middle school or college classrooms because it gets us thinking about climate in a way that is not so myopic and thinking much more universally, actually universally. Let me go ahead and read some feedback from listeners. Alex says, love the connection from The Expanse to climate change and climate change nihilism and denialism. What the series explores, in the books at least, is how each society views responsibility. Belters, as laborers oppressed by Earth and Martian corporations, view labor provided to improve one's habitat or ship as next to godliness. Earth languishes with few jobs specifically because corporate control ran unchecked into global climate catastrophe. Environmental circles are starting to come around on anti-capitalism because it's not wrong to feel guilty about causing climate change. It's wrong to place the onus on individual control versus the actions of multinational companies whose decisions directly affect consumer behavior. That's from Alex. Awesome email, because there's something that Adam and I wanted to make sure we talk about here. Alex, I'm so glad you wrote. By the way, how is Alex's review there? Pretty good framing?
That's pretty good. That's a pretty good framing of, yeah, he's watching and he's paying attention.
He's into it.
Way to go, Alex.
He's into it. On the subject of the narrative, so what Adam is asking us in the Washington Post is to rethink the narrative. Instead of saying climate change is, it's either fingers in my ears, it's not real, or it is real and we're evil and we're a cancer and everything's going to hell. Adam is saying, you know, it's real. We've caused it. And, you know, we should be somewhat impressed with ourselves for doing it. We probably have a lot in common with other technological civilizations, and the challenge now lies at the doorstep. And what are we going to do with it? Same way we talked about capitalism. I feel like with capitalism, there's two narratives. It's either the savior of millions of people who've been pulled out of poverty, or it is evil and needs to be jettisoned entirely. So let's start there, because Alex brings up capitalism. Do you feel like it's too binary when we think about capitalism?
Yeah, I think that you know, one of the problems, and I say this in the article, is that, you know, this usual debate we're having about capitalism versus socialism, you know, you're trying, especially when it comes to climate change, is you're taking like a smokestack era, you know, 19th century model for how economics should be built, and you're trying to shove it down the throat of a problem which has never occurred before, right? The Anthropocene, this new human-dominated era that we've pushed the Earth into, just is not going to fit into Karl Marx or Adam Smith's perspective because it wasn't there. It wasn't built into it. So you can try and pin the tail on the donkey and try and jam climate change onto an Adam Smith or a Karl Marx board. But by doing that, you're just getting the problem wrong. So as I like to say, if your economic theory doesn't have the word planetary in it, you're in the wrong century. So, you know, capitalism has amazing attributes to it. Particularly, it's got the ability, like evolution, to cycle through solutions very quickly until you reach one that works. So, you know, that's a great part of capitalism. On the other hand, the version of capitalism we have now can barely see 4 months in advance. Because, if you're not generating wealth for your investors.
Quarterly reports.
Yeah. Then you're out. And like, you know, climate change is a problem that takes place over a decade. So, you know, the version of capitalism we have right now is literally blind to climate change.
Almost by design.
Exactly.
But not because it's evil.
No, not exactly. Not because it's evil, but because it was built that way. So, you know, people now talk about the idea of regenerative capitalism or donut capitalism, a capitalism that doesn't, like, is not insanely focused on growth, because you can't keep growing, if especially if you're using resources, on a finite planet. So, you know, the idea here is to try and take the best of, you know, various systems and then completely think on the new terms that are required to live on a thriving biosphere. Have a thriving economy on a thriving biosphere. That's the trick.
So Andrew writes to us to say, to what extent does focusing on space take away from a possible sustainable future on Earth, both by diverting resources and the attention our best brains and by making our current situation less dire by giving us a planet B to exploit?
Yeah, I don't actually see that as being a problem at all. First of all, because there is no planet B, right? I mean, there is no time in the near future that you're going to be able to offload enough human beings onto Mars that's actually a viable escape. You know, the gravity well, so to speak, of Earth is pretty deep. It's pretty hard. You know, I forgot what it is, how many millions of dollars it costs to put a pound into space. So, you know, the idea, there's no planet B. But also, let's recognize that if it wasn't for the space program, we wouldn't know climate change was happening, okay? We discovered it because we started putting things in orbit, you know, or at least we came to really understand it because we've started putting things in orbit that could look down. And we had other planets to study. We discovered the dynamics of climate change by looking at Mars and Venus and Titan. I don't see there being any problem with, we're not going to be putting so much resources into space that we're going to stop trying to take care of the Earth. And most importantly, if you want to build a thriving ecosystem under a dome in Mars, you're going to have to understand ecosystems very well, which means you're going to get that from understanding ours. I actually think by trying to settle the solar system, we're going to get a much deeper understanding that we can put into practice on Earth as well.
Different Alex says, what? AOC promised we'd all be dead in 12 years. AOC never said that.
AOC never said that. The you know, what people are saying, and that's really, to even say that really is you're purposely distorting what is a fundamentally important question. Like, really, climate change is an existential, it's quite possibly an existential moment. So unless you purposely weren't paying attention to what that debate was about, you're just distorting it because you want to score political points, which we have no time for right now, okay? The idea is that we've known about climate change for 30 years. The goal has been to try and limit the amount of warming to 2 degrees. And there's a very good reason for that, because the little ice age, which was the last time, you know, Earth saw a significant climate variation, was under 2 degrees, and things managed to be okay. That we have maybe a couple of decades left to do something to stay under that. If not, we're going to blow past it anyway. Once you blow past 2 degrees, you're in uncharted territory, man. You don't know really what's going to happen to the climate system at that point. And, you know, it could be really dangerous for large parts of the human population. Okay, so that's what we're talking about here. And if you're going to play games with, like, oh, we're all going to be dead in 12 years, then, like, you know, either step up or go do something else.
Okay.
No, because this has been going on. This whole idea of climate denial has been going on for so long, and it's getting to the point of absurdity. Look what's going on in California. Look at the cost that people, you know, there's millions of people without power right now because the power company had to turn off the lines to not trigger fires, because they are having these enormous fires because of climate change.
Okay. Michelle from Rochester. Go ahead, Michelle.
I really love this dialogue about the role of narrative in shaping where we want to go. And, you know, the thing that distinguishes our species of ape from other species of ape is language. And we're talking about how are we going to use language to get ourselves out of some pickles that I like the way Adam Frank frames it as kind of inevitable from how we use energy to forward progress. As we're talking about different versions of dystopian futures, I'm curious about your reaction to Omar Al-Akkad's American War, which I read in conjunction with my son, who's a student at School of the Arts. He read it for creative writing. The author came and did a masterclass, and it seemed very realistic to me, but a much bleaker version of what the future can hold and tapping into kind of what is our nature as a human species. So just really curious, in contrast to the more hopeful version of narratives that you've been talking about this hour, where do you put that narrative and its utility for imagining our future.
Michelle, awesome phone call. I'm really glad you called. I hope you'll call again. And I'll start by asking Adam, have you read American
War?
No,
I have
okay.
not.
So I did. In fact, we had the author on, Omar Al-Akkad, who was part of, if all of Rochester read the same book, Rochester Reads, the program through Writers and Books. The book is phenomenal. The first 100 pages of the book, I thought it really was a book about our climate future 70 years into the future. Mm. It's really a book about terrorism in the human psyche. And it's a very, it's about a lot of things. It's really worth reading. But the premise is 70 years into the future, Florida is essentially underwater. The coastal areas are underwater. We have not stopped the rise of the oceans. It is now illegal to burn fossil fuels. The regimes are very oppressive with their rules. Mm. People are fleeing to the north where it's easier to sort of more comfortably live, and people in the south are suffering. Food is scarce. War is happening. And so, yes, the version there is kind of bleak. What I thought was helpful about that was it is one version of a possibility, which is in the next century, we could see ocean rise. I don't know if all of Florida is going to be underwater, but go ask Miami and Miami Beach now what they're experiencing, yeah. coastal areas there. And I think asking us to imagine that and the consequences, and then what it does to people in poverty, what it does to inequality, what it does, after our only break, we'll talk about climate justice mm-hmm. here. But does that sound too bleak, or do you think it's worth considering?
Oh, no, I think it's so another author who I particularly like, I can't pronounce his name, Paolo Bagalucci. I'm having a hard, always have a hard time with it.
I think that's correct.
The Water Knife. The Water Knife is a fascinating book. Same sort of thing taking place about 50 years in the Southwest, where basically, you know, prolonged drought has completely changed the landscape. Texas is just full of refugees, climate refugees. So it's a similar book. I think those books are important for us to understand exactly, to unpack what it will look like, what climate change will look like, both, you know, you want to look at it both in its most dire consequences and also challenges. There's also Kim Stanley Robinson's New York 2140, which is a fascinating book about New York after the oceans rise. And the idea that, like, the tides are going to run up from, like, 60th Street down to 30th Street each day, right? Because the rest of it is underwater. And that's actually, that's an interesting version that's hopeful still. Like, in the sense that humanity's held together, enormous challenges, things are hard, but, you know, it's still, we're holding it together. So I think all of these, the whole range, are really important for people to look at so you can try and help you imagine what might this look like for both the hopeful versions and the really scary versions.
Ruth writes to us to say, I love this conversation as an organic farmer and a sci-fi nerd and an Expanse fan.
Oh, yeah.
I can commiserate with Adam about finding awesome details and also terrible details in futuristic movies and shows. Interstellar comes to mind because I loved most of that movie, except the premise drove me crazy. They obviously did not talk to any farmers or soil scientists. Adam, do you want to start a specialist-centered consulting firm with Hollywood with me?
Absolutely, yeah, yeah, and we'll hire ourselves out
yes.
to give realistic but dramatically exciting alternatives for the future.
I love that. Hey, Ruth, thank you very much. I actually wondered how the idea of sort of barren farmland played out to reality that Interstellar portrayed. And Ruth, shoot me a separate note because I would love to hear a little bit more of your thoughts on that. I appreciate that.
I hadn't thought of that. That's a really cool
it's a great
idea.
Point.
That's
yeah.
a really great point.
It's a great
yeah.
point. So we're talking about the climate story, both now, the way we think of it now, the way it either sort of inhibits or allows us to think about solutions in the future, and then what Hollywood, what novelists are doing with that climate future. Adam Frank is our guest. He is an astrophysicist, professor of astrophysics at the University of Rochester, author of Light of the Stars, Alien Worlds and the Fate of the Earth, and a super fanboy for The Expanse, which all of our listeners are going to go watch now.
And give it time, though. Remember, the first, it's like The Wire. You got to watch. It's going to take like 4 episodes before you're really sort of seeing it. So
for
give
me,
yourself time.
That's how Shite's Creek was. I don't think I can say it, so I'll say Shite's Creek. I watched the first 2 or 3 episodes. I went, this is so thin. Why am I? And now it's the most heartful human story on television. It's fabulous.
You're a fanboy.
I love you, Moira. So we're going to get our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back, and we're going to talk about that narrative, that story that we tell about climate change, and how Adam has been thinking about things like climate justice and more. That's next. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about police accountability. Rochesterians will decide on a police accountability board, a proposed mechanism to give more teeth and more disciplinary power to a board overseeing police action. The police union opposes it. They say there already is accountability, and this would make their work more difficult and more dangerous. The advocates will join us as well, a debate of sorts next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Adam Frank, astrophysicist who's written a lot about climate change, is our guest for the hour. He is our reviewer for the hour. And now, as we talk about The Expanse Season 4, which is coming, I think, in December.
Yes.
You're very excited about that. This is Earth is a planet in 200 years in the future with oceans that have risen. Food is relatively scarce. Resources are scarce. 30 billion people, most without jobs. And that brings to mind for me the phrase climate justice, because already we're seeing who is impacted by climate more so than who is not right now. How are you thinking about that phrase these days?
Well, it's interesting because, thinking about it deeply is relatively new for me. It's not like I didn't know about the term, but, my son and my daughter both sort of have interests along these lines in different ways, and they've put books in my hands that have really kind of, changed my life in terms of thinking of this. Because, I recognize as I'm going out and talking to people about, like, hey, here's this hopeful narrative of challenge and possibility and risk about climate change. It also, I need to think more about the fact that, look, those of us in the developed world, quote-unquote developed world, we are the ones who put the CO2 into the atmosphere. And, some family living in the Amazon, didn't really do this, and yet they're the ones who may face the largest consequences of this. So, I think there's we have to recognize that climate change, not all of us created the climate change, and not all of us are going to suffer from its consequences equally. And that is important to remember, because no matter what, we want a just society. But even more than that is you're not going to be able to deal with the changes. You're not going to be able to create the changes you need to move from one fuel or one energy source to the other without having everybody on board. And that includes, when we talk about climate justice, it's not just the Amazon. It's the blue collar oil worker, in the South, who's going to lose their job. The coal workers who are going to lose their job. Like, we have to switch from these things. We can't just be like, well, tough luck for you.
Or like, you've been mining coal, you're bad.
Right,
those
exactly.
People are not bad.
They're not bad. It was a job. It's a job that was in their families
in a place
years.
Where there are not jobs.
Where there are not other jobs, right? And they were good jobs. They were well-paying jobs, at least some of them. And so climate justice means recognizing that if you're going to make a profound shift from one energy modality to another, really rebuild your infrastructure, you got to take into account the people, the rich people, the oil executives. I'm not concerned about them,
No, but we're not talking about Massey Energy CEOs here.
Right, right. We're talking about the guy on the line, the woman working, herself on the line or in the office. Because we need everybody on board for this. And if you're not going to help the people who are going to be displaced, if you're not going to help the people who are going to be impacted by the change, then there's no way why should they get on board? So my understanding is the yellow vest protests in Paris,
yeah,
and which paralyzed the government, started because there was a tax that was put on gasoline that was supposed to be a climate related tax, right? So there you see that you can't just sort of say, oh, we're going to have a non progressive tax on carbon and then expect everybody to jump on board.
Because who gets hammered the most?
Right, exactly. I'm not going to be I probably get paid enough that I'm it's not going to matter if you put another 20 cents on my per gallon. But for somebody who has two kids and is has an average income, that's going to be a huge impact.
Do you think, generally speaking, the political left ignores some of those realities or speaks too monolithically about coal, oil, gas, without realizing there's real hardworking human beings who are worried about losing their jobs, and we need to think about the consequences for them when we move into a new energy future?
I think it has to be, it needs to be front and center in a way that it's not. I mean, sort of like, the very progressive left, that's what the Green New Deal tries to address that. Some of the issues of the Green New Deal tries to throw everything into that. But certainly the Green New Deal tries to deal with the fact that, look, you've got to help the people who are going to be negatively impacted by this shift. I think that really needs to be front and center to be able to make sure that we get everybody on board with the changes that are going to be required.
And so on the subject of inevitability, we are going to be talking on Friday about AI. And I think our entire audience is going to love it, but because it's going to be this really interesting conversation about inevitability,
yeah,
and what it means. And so I take your point largely that when you say technological civilizations here and in other solar systems and other galaxies probably run into the same kind of energy feedback and climate change and face the same great filter that we may be facing, that it's probably inevitable that that happens when there is intelligent life that becomes technological. I take that point. I'm wondering on the AI side, here's how it's been framed during in the last few months, because you got Andrew Yang in the presidential campaign talking about a universal basic income of $1,000 a month because automation doesn't just hit McDonald's. It's going to a lot of different sectors. And he's not wrong about that. But Slate's Jordan Weissman had a piece last week in which he said, Andrew Yang is full of it. And here's why. He's not wrong about AI and what it's doing to take jobs away. He's wrong to say, well, it's inevitable, so let's just give people $1,000 a month, instead of saying, can we have a conversation first? Do we want that? And can we stop it? Is that part also inevitable, too?
Okay, wait. So for climate change, the whole point of climate change, of switching energy infrastructures, is to now make it not inevitable, right? What I think is inevitable is that you trigger it. What's not inevitable is that you're
destroyed by it.
You're too dumb to sort of do anything about it. Yeah. I mean, that's what sort of separates the winners from the losers cosmically. The winner civilizations are the ones who recognize what they're doing and then figure out, like, oh, we got to change infrastructures so that, you know, we can have a thriving biosphere and a thriving economy. The losers are just, for whatever reason, can't get it together to pull back. So, you know, there's a certain way in which the laws of planetary dynamics and thermodynamics mean that if you're using a lot of energy, you're going to have a feedback, you're going to trigger an Anthropocene. But the next step is sort of, that's determined by kind of, you know, your how quickly you can evolve your ideas and behavior.
And so on the AI, I know it's a separate category, but do you view that also technologically
no.
as inevitable?
AI is something I think very different.
We can pull back from that, you think?
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, that is a choice about technologies. I mean, look, Betamax versus VHS, right? There have been times when we've made decisions about technology. You know, the invisible hand of the market. One way or the other, we've chosen certain technologies over other. Yeah, I get really, I'm quite upset about the idea that this sort of sense of like, oh, this technology just has to happen. No, like driverless cars. Who says that we have to have driverless cars? I mean, maybe that's a good idea, but like, there should be a discussion. There should be some way we should get a vote rather than just having it shoved down our throats by people who stand to make money off of it.
Stand to make money and then maybe not thinking about unintended consequences.
Right.
There's a very smart guy named Matt Kelly who's going to be on the program on Friday who recently articulated a very interesting point to me, and I'm not sure Matt claims credit for himself, but he's relaying the idea that tools, whether it's a hammer, a telephone, whatever, are designed to make the human experience easier. So they're designed to supplement the human experience. They're not designed to replace the need for humans.
Right.
That's the difference with AI.
Right.
Is it enhancing what we do or is it replacing what we do?
Right.
And maybe that should be the dividing line.
And there should be a discussion about it. There should be, you know, digital technologies have transformed human civilization so fast and so profoundly that we need to really have the ability to step back. And that's what legislation and policy is all about. Step back and, like, take a break for a little while and think about these things rather than, again, it's these companies who stand to make a lot of money are telling us, like, oh, of course you have to have this. Of course this is going to happen. You know, we've seen the detriment to democracies that have happened because of something like social media. So absolutely, we should get a say in how we want to proceed with these.
All right, down to our last minute or so. So for the people who read your Washington Post piece, and you ought to read Adam's newest piece. What's it called, by the way? I know you don't title these
things. I don't title these things, so I've forgotten what they said. I forgot what the title is.
It's about a new narrative or a new story on climate
right.
change. And for the people who read that and say, no, we need to have a reckoning. We have done terrible things. We are bad, and we are a cancer on this planet. What do you say?
I say that, first of all, that's wrong. I mean, I would argue that's scientifically wrong. And second of all, it's not useful. So, you know, there's this thing of like, you know, is whatever you, before you say anything, is it true and is it useful? And, you know, there's only so much you can only beat people over the head so often. All you're really doing is just re-traumatizing yourself every time you tell that untrue story. And you're not going to win any converts. You're not going to get the action you want by telling that story. There is a different story which is both true and hopeful about climate change. Doesn't mean we're going to make it. Doesn't take away the responsibility to act now. But it's a story that can carry us into the future, because stories are were humanity's first technology. If you miss that point, you think you're going to do it all with just data. You know, you're not paying attention.
All right. So as we close, our thanks to Adam Frank. Scott writes, any chance of posting the list of books and movies mentioned on today's show? Couldn't write them down in the car. Adam is the best, one of the only people who makes me rethink things in ways I never suspected. That's from Scott, Adam's father. I'm just kidding. No, we don't know. That's not from anyone related to Adam. It's great praise. The books. The book series is The Expanse, which has been turned into a show, which is entering its fourth season, the fourth season coming out in December.
On Amazon.
On Amazon. The movie Ad Astra, don't see it, Adam says. That's a mess. One of the books is American War by Omar El Akkad. Other books?
The Water Knife.
The Water Knife.
By Paolo Bagagliucci.
And we will post them on our podcast page, wxxinews.org/connections. Thank you, as always.
So much fun, Adam.
That's Adam Frank. More connections coming up.